Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, fighting for survival. Government bailouts have helped many airlines avoid bankruptcy, but not all states have deep pockets. And who would be thinking about starting an airline in the midst of a pandemic? We speak to the chief executive of a Norwegian startup. The Biden administration's move to counter Beijing's economic and diplomatic reach in Latin America. But is it too late to recover Washington's diminished influence in the region? As Tesla becomes the first $1 trillion automaker, could this be the future of the trucking industry? It may look like any other truck on our roads, but this is also powered by electricity. For the global economy to recover fully from the pandemic, there is an industry that needs to make a comeback: tourism. It represents a tenth of the global economy, and the pandemic has wiped out 120 million tourism jobs. But that recovery depends on more travel corridors and countries opening their borders. And with the lack of vaccines for the world's poorest, that's unlikely to happen before late 2022. We're going to focus on the crucial role that airlines play in that recovery. And as always, we'll start with the numbers. After the worst year on record, the industry is predicting losses of $52 billion this year. Losses are likely to persist next year, but should shrink to $12 billion. Tourists travelling by air are expected to spend $354 billion this year. Now, that sounds huge, but that's more than 40% less than before the pandemic. Airlines continue to receive life support from governments, totaling some $243 billion since the start of the pandemic. Carriers in this region, the Middle East, which rely on international traffic, have been fortunate to have the support of state aid. Qatar Airways received $3 billion, but still cut 15%, or more than 13,000 employees, from its workforce. Regional rival and one of the most profitable airlines, Emirates, made a loss of $5.5 billion last year and received more than $3 billion from Dubai's government. In the US and Europe, governments opted for a mixture of loans and furlough schemes to keep airlines flying. But not all governments have deep pockets, and some airlines are struggling for survival. For example, AirAsia X has liabilities of $8.1 billion, half of which is due to cancelling airplane orders from Airbus. The Malaysian low-cost long-haul airline is working on a deal to pay just 0.5% of the debt that it owes. Neighbouring Thai Airways, back in June, won a court order to restructure debts of $12.9 billion. However, the airline was in difficulty well before the coronavirus pandemic grounded many flights across the globe. And then there's Indonesia's national carrier Garuda, which is on the brink of bankruptcy. The Indonesian government is devising a takeover plan if the company is unable to renegotiate leases and restructure its debt. Al Jazeera's Jessica Washington reports from Jakarta.
At Indonesia's largest airport, passenger traffic is on the rise as domestic tourism enjoys a resurgence. After months of relative quiet, travel restrictions at major airports around the country are easing as the number of COVID-19 cases falls. It's a welcome change for the country's aviation industry, but it may not be enough to save one major player. Drowning in debt, the country's oldest airline, Garuda Indonesia, is edging close to bankruptcy.
It's not a pretty picture, in terms of the debts amounting to hundreds of trillions of rupiah, which is coming up to billions. This is the largest debt that Garuda has had so far in its history.
The pandemic had a severe impact on the flag carrier. Passenger numbers have fallen by 90%, and flight frequency has reduced from 400 to less than 100 flights a day. The airline's total debt is now $4.9 billion, and the company faces several lawsuits over unpaid debts.
It's very difficult to imagine in Indonesia with a, you know, Indonesia with a Garuda, but you know, there has to be a point where somebody says enough's enough. Clean up or you're gone.
The airline CEO, Irfan Setiaputra, told Al Jazeera steps have been taken to turn the company around, including renegotiating airplane leasing costs and restructuring loans. He says the reopening of international borders offers more hope. Like many airlines around the world, Garuda Indonesia has struggled through the pandemic because of travel-related restrictions. But Garuda's financial woes started long before the pandemic, and now the flag carrier faces an uncertain future.
Aviation experts say Garuda Indonesia has struggled to compete with low-cost carriers, grappling with weak earnings while paying for a large and expensive fleet of aircraft that are mostly leased. Analysts also say the airline's management persisted with unpopular routes, which became known as ghost flights due to a lack of passengers.
Garuda actually are facing financial distress just back before pandemic. So 5 years earlier, we see some of the operational costs of Garuda is increased dramatically. And then some of the international flight, for example, Jakarta-London, is not profitable.
The airline is still mostly owned by the government, and the Ministry of State-Owned Enterprises has proposed rebranding a state-owned charter service, Pelita Air, as a passenger carrier to replace Garuda, or putting in more state cash. The ministry declined an interview with Al Jazeera.
The option of the bankruptcy liquidation of Garuda is very like a feasible option right now. And also about the state budget. If the government bail out the Garuda, it needs more than 4.9 billion. And on the other hand, the Indonesia government is still focusing on the major infrastructure project that need more fund.
Under pressure to resolve the crisis at Garuda, the government faces a difficult choice: either try and save the failing airline or let it collapse.
Well, against that backdrop, imagine trying to start a new airline. I'm delighted to say, joining us now is someone who's doing just that. Bjørn Tore Larsen is chief executive of Norwegian low-cost airline Norse Atlantic Airways. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. via Skype. Bjørn, really good to have you with us. Why now? Is this really the right time to be starting an airline when so many others are struggling?
That's a good question, but we think it is exactly the right time to do so. If there ever was a time, it would be now. And the reason for that is that due to the pandemics, a lot of airlines had, unfortunately, to ground their aircraft and to cease operations. And that has made us able to acquire a good number of very modern aircraft at record low prices. So we are starting off from a point that nobody have done before. And secondly, we have an abundance of people who are very keen to join this airline and who want to build something new and fresh. It doesn't mean that we will start operating right now, because that might not have been that wise, again, due to pandemic. But this is exactly the right time to create a foundation for what is going to be a competitive and affordable low-cost carrier.
And you think that you're going to be able to crack the long-haul discount market after Norwegian Air's exit from transatlantic routes? You're even taking some of the staff who worked on that operation. Is history going to repeat itself, or are you turning over a new leaf here?
We are a totally new company, and we have nothing to do with the other airline. Having said that, we have taken on a few people who have been with that airline and experienced in transatlantic flying. And also, we have made an historic agreement with the American Flight Attendants Union, AFA, by ensuring that many of the previous flight attendants that were working on some of the Norwegian aircraft are actually going to join our airline, which is great for us and also very good for the employees. But our model is very different than other airlines. We are a point-to-point carrier. We have very little complexity in our model, and that is much of the reason why we can have the lowest cost in the industry.
All right, but one of your competitors is JetBlue, who've started to fly across the Atlantic too. It's a really tough sector to fly to be competitive on, isn't it?
It's very competitive, and competition is great. JetBlue is also a great company, and I have deep respect for what they are doing. They are targeting perhaps a little different market than we are. Their product is more directed towards the business market than ours, probably. But we acknowledge that there is many competitors, and we have respect for them, and we think competition is very good, both for the consumer, but also for us. Competition just makes it better.
All right, so when do you think you'll have the first plane in the air?
That's going to be this spring, spring 2022.
OK. How long do you think it's going to take the airline industry to return to some semblance of pre-pandemic normality?
Of course, it depends on how the coronavirus develops going forward, but we see that in domestic America, for example, or within Europe, you are close to pre-pandemic levels. And the reason for that is that regulations have eased so that people can actually travel. And we think the same thing will happen in long haul when regulations are eased. I think this is really the key. People really want to travel. There is a pent-up demand for people who want to travel, but right now they're not allowed to. We estimate that 2022 will be not perhaps at pre-pandemic levels across the Atlantic, but getting close there. 2023, we think, is going to be a good year for long haul, and 2024, in our estimation, will be the time where we will be beyond or above the levels that we had before the pandemic. But obviously, there are a few unknown here, and one of them is how this virus develops going forward.
Something like 40 airlines collapsed during the pandemic. Do you think we're going to see more collapsing before things actually begin to improve?
I think you will always see airlines collapsing, either because of strategy, cost structure, whatever they have. And that will happen both in a crisis situation like now and normally due to competition. And that might very well happen again. We see airlines who have already announced that they will need more capital in order to be able to survive. But I don't necessarily see that the big wave is going to be hit right now, as those have probably already been severely affected. But it depends on how every company is capitalized.
And what about jobs? With so many lost during the course of the pandemic, do you think we'll ever get those jobs back, or are we now perhaps more at realistic numbers for the airline industry?
I think, the sad thing is that a lot of jobs might have been lost permanently. People have found other industries. And today, it's actually hard finding people for many airlines and other aviation companies due to people who left the industry are not coming back. And the second thing we are seeing is that there is an acute shortage of pilots in many areas in the world. In America, for example, where I am right now, there are not enough pilots. So several airlines are struggling to fly due to lack of competent crew, and this is a trend we think is going to strengthen as we get back to normality in the airline business, which of course is a challenge for us all. And our ambition is to be the best employer of air crew, both pilots and flight attendants. And by that, by taking good care of our people, we think they will take care of the company and will be an attractive employer. But we recognize it's going to be tough to find the best people.
Bjorn, you're a brave man. We wish you the very best of luck with it. Thank you so much for being with us on Counting the Cost. Really good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
As China accelerated its economic expansion in Latin America, the Biden administration is moving to counter Beijing's trillion-dollar Belt and Road Initiative with an initiative of its own called Build Back Better for the World. But as Al Jazeera's Lucia Newman reports now from Santiago, Chile, it could be too little, too late to recover Washington's diminished influence in the region.
For South and Central America, the new north is east, especially China. And it should come as no surprise. In just 20 years, China's trade with the region has soared from less than $18 billion to more than $315 billion. Everywhere you look, U.S. products have been replaced by Chinese goods.
During the Cold War, and in fact way before that, the United States considered Latin America its backyard, employing its famous carrot and stick policy to ensure that its interests were respected. Today, it's not the American, but the Chinese presence that's far more visible here. And it goes way beyond cheap Chinese imports.
19 Latin American and Caribbean countries have joined China's signature Belt and Road Initiative, a $1 trillion transcontinental trade and infrastructure network. It includes key infrastructure projects, cyberspace, energy industries, transportation hubs, roads, telecommunications, agriculture, and even military training. Here in Chile, as in Brazil and Argentina, Chinese COVID vaccines have been made widely available as part of a new and aggressive medical diplomacy strategy. It reflects China's global soft power and influence. In this case, a bit too close to home for Washington's liking.
The United States tends to view this in geostrategic terms and tends to see this in terms of China somehow securing outsized influence beyond the economic sphere in Latin America.
U.S. diplomats and the Pentagon have expressed concern about, quote, predatory trade practices that they argue are giving China excessive geopolitical leverage. Adding insult to injury, in June, longtime U.S. ally Panama joined the Dominican Republic and El Salvador in switching recognition of Taiwan for China. Another sign of how much Washington's leadership and influence in the region has diminished. It's in this context that the Biden administration is launching an offensive called Build Back Better for the World, or B3W for short, to compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative.
And for the United States, this is strategic. When we think about our global stature, enhancing the prosperity, the economic prosperity of our friends, is at least as important as our military might.
Washington says its proposed infrastructure program will be values-driven and transparent, focusing on digital technology, health and health security, climate, and gender equity and equality.
This is amusing, kind of like a guy who's ignoring his girlfriend, then notices that he has competition and suddenly realizes that he really wants her. In any case, I don't know how strong this proposal to contribute to Latin American infrastructure can be if the United States still can't agree on its own domestic infrastructure program.
This as China is considering a transcontinental railroad linking Brazil in the Atlantic to Chile in the Pacific, after having just signed a $4.7 billion accord with Argentina to revamp its railway infrastructure.
I think that there are some things that China has been providing that the United States is simply not in a position to do. The fact of the matter is that China is now the largest trading partner for Peru, for Chile, for Brazil, for Uruguay, for Paraguay. That's not going to change.
But Hirschberg argues that the United States can and should identify areas where it can be a dynamic and constructive partner with Latin America, such as renewable energy or the transfer of technology. Unlike China, Latin America and the U.S. do share cultural ties. But there's also a checkered history, which is why most Latin American countries are watching Washington and Beijing compete for their favor, convinced that when it comes to trade, being monogamous is no longer in their best interests.
Tesla joined an elite club of companies valued at more than $1 trillion. That's after it landed one of the biggest orders for electric vehicles from the rental car company Hertz. Now, if anything, the deal finally cements the electric car's rise from a niche product to the future of the auto industry. Well, while Tesla has ambitions to top the entire auto industry in sales over the next decade, the $368 billion heavy truck industry is wide open for a similar disruptor. A gaggle of big names dominate the sector and have plans to start electrifying their vehicles. Teva, a British electric truck startup, has raised millions of dollars to roll out its own environmentally friendly delivery trucks. With an electric charge, the truck can cover 250 kilometres and with a hydrogen range extender can do 500 kilometres. Well, let's talk to the director of Teva right now. David Thackeray joins us from London via Skype. David, good to have you with us. What do you make of Tesla's extraordinary market capitalisation?
Well, I think the first thing you would say is it is extraordinary. It's uncanny, isn't it, that by now they exceed the market cap of the other 10 top players in the market. And when you consider that they were only at maybe $40 2 years ago, now to be at $1,040 is a remarkable achievement. And I think it demonstrates how the investment community of this world sees which way the automotive industry is moving.
All right, so what progress is being made in your part of the industry, the truck industry? There's you. What about the competition?
Well, I think you'd say progress is slower. I think the progress is slower primarily because the main incumbent players haven't contributed, if you like, in the same way. Yes, you know, obviously we're out there doing the best that we can. There are others along with us, but, you know, you could look at people like BYD, you could look at people like Lion, Hylion, Hyzon, Arrival. There's a good number of new market entrants in the game. But it is those new players that are driving the heavy truck industry, not the incumbent players.
I wanted to ask you about that. Compared to the likes of Scania and Mercedes, you're just a minnow. That doesn't concern you then?
No, it doesn't. It genuinely doesn't. Two, three years ago, you would say Tesla was a minnow in comparison to the overall market. They were producing perhaps a quarter of a million cars versus a global market of almost 100 million. So, yeah, they were absolute minnow just 3 years ago. We, in the next couple of years, will be at a similar level of market penetration. So, no, it really does not surprise me. It doesn't bother me in any way, shape at all.
Okay.
All those big players, you know, the Scanias, the Volvos, et cetera, that you mentioned, they all have products that they can produce, but you will notice that they are choosing not to sell them at market viable costs. And I guess you just have to ask yourself, why would they make that choice?
You gave yourself a time frame there. The size of the electric truck market was what, worth around $1 billion in 2020? By 2027, it's predicted to be $14 billion. That's a slower uptake when you compare it to the uptake of electric cars, isn't it?
It is if you believe the forecasts. I'm not sure that I do. I tend not to look at forecasts for, you know, the, quote, electric truck market. I think in terms of, you know, what is the actual truck market? And the truck market as a whole is probably worth, in the medium-duty sector, probably about in the order of $200 billion or thereabouts. That's all trucks. And I would strongly argue that certainly by 2040, 100% of that will be electric, probably a good bit before that time.
So when can we expect to see your trucks on the road? I mean, I'm not expecting you to divulge business secrets here, but are there any pre-orders, large customers that you can tell us about?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there's just, I guess, one quick point I'd just like to put out first, which is in terms of the uptake. So the uptake has been stymied, I think, by the supply. If you look at people like Amazon, you look at FedEx, you look at DHL, you look at UPS, all those big, big global fleets have all taken control of supply because they can't get the supply from the incumbent OEMs. So the fact that they're willing to actually start producing vehicles themselves in many ways just tells you that they are ready to go as soon as the product is there. In terms of ours, we will have our first vehicles on the road Q3 next year.
That's excellent. What about startups who specialise in autonomous delivery trucks? Does that pose a threat to your business?
No, not in any way, shape or form. I think autonomous is something that will be... I think it's fair to say I would expect autonomous technologies to be incremental. They'll come in stages. I don't think we'll suddenly go from vehicles with drivers to vehicles without drivers. But you'll just find more and more of the functions can be done autonomous incrementally. Certainly, it's something that we're looking at, and it will be something that we will be including and building into our technology as we go forward. You know, we are first and foremost a technology company. You know, we're a technology company that produces trucks primarily.
And one final question, David. Why would you choose the UK as a manufacturing base, given that the post-Brexit trading difficulties that we're seeing right now?
I think straightforwardly, the UK is where we were born. The UK is where we've grown up. The UK is not the place that we will be manufacturing solely. You know, we will continue to manufacture in the UK. Make no mistake about that. There's a great skill base in the UK. And as I say, it's our home. But equally, as we go forward, we will be opening manufacturing capability within mainland Europe and certainly within North America.
We wish you all the best, David. Good luck with it. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Many thanks. Thanks for having me on.
And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything that you've seen, you can tweet me. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Please use the hashtag AJCTC if you do, or you can drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page, and there you'll find entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.